And our preaching text today, Romans 2, 12 to 24, on page 940 in your pew Bible. For all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law, and all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. For it is not the hearers of the law who are righteous before God, but the doers of the law who will be justified. For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them on that day when, according to my gospel, God judges the secrets of men by Christ Jesus. But if you call yourself a Jew and rely on the law and boast in God and know his will and approve what is excellent, because you are instructed from the law, and if you are sure that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of children, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? While you preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that one must not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law, dishonor God by breaking the law. For as it is written, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. The greatest dramatic portrayal of guilt and the human conscience, for my money anyway. If you know of a better one, let me know. Act 1, Scene 1 of Shakespeare's Macbeth. Master and Lady Macbeth have murdered King Duncan of Scotland in order to come to the throne themselves, and Macbeth has been recalcitrant throughout the play and of a more tender conscience than his wife, Lady Macbeth. She's quite a character, isn't she? I'd hate to be her enemy. She's always chided and scoffed at her husband for being so waffling and scrupulous and guilt-ridden. He's already remarked that though the deed was now done and they were ensconced in the throne of power without even a hint of scandal in the kingdom, Macbeth has lamented in a moment of guilt-ridden conscience that not even the ocean could wash his hands clean of Duncan's blood. After telling him to buck up, play the man, smile, enjoy his power a little bit, she experiences a night witnessed by her handmaid and doctor, unbeknownst to her. She sleepwalks through the castle, symbolic as well here, constantly rubbing her hands in a cleansing motion over and over. Yet here's a spot, out damned spot. In a classic obsessive compulsive disorder, right, long before it was named, Lady Macbeth is trying to erase an imaginary blood spot on her hands from the murder of Duncan. But it will not come clean. That's because it's not a literal blood spot, but one of her own imagination, generated to her sight by her guilty conscience. Therefore, it will never come clean until her conscience is assuaged, but rather will always from here on be present as long as she has a conscience, and she ends up committing suicide at the end of the play. That it happens while she sleepwalks is significant too. It tells us her conscious mind is capable of suppressing her guilt. The Apostle Paul has already talked about that, hasn't he, in chapter 1. While she is awake, in fact, she's able to be more manly about this than her husband, but that her unconscious mind still bears the truth of her deed to her conscience. And when given the space to speak as it does in sleep, her conscience speaks by spotting her hand with the blood of Duncan. Conscience is a pesky thing, isn't it? The human conscience is a pesky thing. I see some looks of recognition out there. Our conscience seems to be wired into every human soul. None of the lies we tell ourselves that power and destiny belong to the strong and the bold, that guilt is but a sign of weakness to keep us from fulfilling our own self-interest, that neither God nor history will bring us to account, all of which Macbeth uses to justify his crime. None of this seems able to silence the voice of conscience telling us that we have transgressed a law of God written indelibly upon our hearts. That's our title today, Indelible. There's something indelibly written upon the human heart that even without the written, the explicit law of God still speaks. Macbeth was not the first to assert this, although I think Shakespeare is probably the most eloquent in dramatizing it, and please tell me if there's something more eloquent to dramatize it. Some good work has been done in this area, too. Long before, the Apostle Paul, however, in the text before us, tells us these same truths, okay? Shakespeare knew his Bible. Too bad Macbeth didn't, but Shakespeare knew his Bible. And every one of his plays has biblical themes throughout. Indelible, this is the title of our message today, verses 12 through 16, first of all. Indelible. God's judgment is righteous and impartial. Paul is continuing his sustained argument. And he's making the point that God's judgment is righteous and impartial, as we saw last week, towards all men because it is manifest in even Gentiles without the law, the revealed law, that they have a version of it intrinsic to their hearts. Every man has law, the revealed law, intrinsic to their hearts. Therefore, there are no innocent natives in Africa. Because they have the law intrinsic to their hearts, they have a conscience that convicts them. Verses 12 through 16. That there is something indelible about God's law written upon the human soul is crucial to Paul's extended argument for the acquisition of the righteousness of God. Once again, Romans is an extended argument on the righteousness of God. What it is, why we don't have it, why we need it, how do we acquire it, and then how do we live out that righteousness in our daily lives once we have acquired it. Romans, eloquent. This extended argument that he makes, not for the person with ADD. You have to think from one week to the other what has preceded and then what is to come. It is a complex but understandable argument. It is counterintuitive to the human soul, but it is non-contradictory. Now, Paul has just given a blanket universal truth. He will render to each one according to his works. He's establishing the works principle upon which God judges every human soul. He will render to each one according to his works, for God shows no partiality. In the section that we read from last week, right? God shows no partiality toward any man. He will render to each one according to his works. But Paul is also writing to a mixed congregation of Jew and Gentile, in which one group, the Jews, would be tempted to say, au contraire, Paul, God is partial. He's partial to us for giving us the covenant and its knowledge of God. While the Gentiles were tempted to say, we can't possibly be as accountable to God since we have not had the privileges and knowledge that the Jews have had. He's been partial to the Jews. Paul has just stated flatly, God shows no partiality. And he begins to counter these obvious objections by turning then to the Gentiles first in our section today. So voila, we begin here. But remember, he's establishing the works principle here on which all men will be judged. And he says to the Gentiles, just because you have no extrinsic law like the Jew, that is on the outside, the non-subjective law, if you will, the specially revealed law, just because you don't have that, which is also glorious, deeply personal, as Paul will later explicate in various places in Romans. Just because you don't have this glorious covenant and law doesn't mean you have no intrinsic law given to all men. Intrinsic, that is general, prosaic, common, universal. And he begins by telegraphing. Now note how he begins to telegraph what his final conclusion will be regarding all this law stuff. That is, Gentile and Jew will perish alike, law or no law. In verse 12, he says, "For all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law." Now, he doesn't say they'll live without the law either. He's telegraphing what the conclusion of all this law stuff will be. "And all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law." A parallel. That is, both of you will die. Unless something or someone intervenes, right? It's a classic parallelism. Both classes die. Paul is true to his principles here, too. Law cannot give life. Law cannot give life. Your obedience to the law is worthless in terms of giving life. Paul says in Galatians chapter 3, "For if a law had been given that could give life, then righteousness would indeed be by the law." Lots of labor on this very same theme in Galatians, too. Funny how the human heart needs this repetition. Repetition is the soul of learning, and I hope that you are learning today. Indeed, law cannot give life. Consequently, your obedience to the law, as imperfect as all of ours is, will not give life, but only death. Yet Paul continues to hold out the ground of justification. Obedience to the law is the ground of justification. If any of us had the ability to meet that ground, that is perfect, complete, and entire obedience. Paul establishes, once again, going on to establish the ground of our justification. He says, "For it is not the hearers of the law." That little word, "for," once again, a deductive preposition saying what follows is based on what precedes. There are three fours here, aren't they? Three fours, yes, three fours. And then note the three strings of logical pearls here, that is, deductive conclusions drawn from previous points established. It is not the hearers of the law who are righteous before God. Jews in Old Testament constantly speak of, "Hear, O Israel." Right from our own text today, chapter 4, Deuteronomy. "Hear, O Israel, but the doers of the law who will be justified," he says. It is the doers of the law who will be justified, establishing the works principle. Perfect, complete, and entire doers of the law. Complete obedience. Paul knows that both of his audiences will agree. Not only the Old Testament, but also the Talmud for example, not the expounding of the law, Aboth says, is the chief thing, but the doing of it. In verses 14 to 15, Paul now does a nice job of oscillating. I want you to follow closely here with me in verses 14 and 15. He does a nice job of oscillating between two senses of the law. Once again, you have to follow his argument. You have to follow his train of thought if you are going to comprehend Romans, and consequently, if you are going to acquire righteousness, the righteousness that saves. If you are going to be justified such that you are righteous before God, and that's what he requires, you may be bored by it. It may be a topic you'd rather be on Facebook, but you better pay some attention to the righteousness of God if you expect to get to heaven. Because that is what he requires. So, let's look in verses 14 and 15 between this oscillating sense, two senses of law in which he uses here. That is, that which the Jews have from Sinai, that's one sense of the law. Special revelation. Law A, if you will. That which the Jews have from Sinai, that law. And then there is that law which all men have written in their hearts as a function of bearing the image of God. Natural revelation, or law B, we'll call it. Now notice how he does this. Verses 14 and 15, go ahead and look at that as we go through it. For when the Gentiles who do not have the law, that's law A here, that is that which the Jews do have. For when the Gentiles who do not have that law, by nature do what that law, once again, law A requires, they are a law, law B, okay? That which is written on the heart of Gentiles. This is the sense of law B. They are a law which has, I'm sorry, they are a law even though they do not have the law. That is law A, forming an inclusio with the first phrase, okay? A little complex, but understandable, comprehensible. In verses 15 through 16, Paul expands upon what he means, that Gentiles can be a law unto themselves. Once again, they have that law in their hearts, and they are indeed a law unto themselves, are they not? They, by nature, do what the law requires. They are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law from Sinai. So what Paul is doing here is expanding upon what he means that Gentiles can be a law unto themselves in verses 15 to 16. Isolated from its context, it can be taken to mean that we can do the law so as to merit justification. That's why you have to keep these in the sustained argument in which Paul presents it. Taken out of its context, those interpreters with ADD, right? Forget what's gone before. We'll forget this when they move on, right? But as we saw last week, this is precisely what some will do. Well-meaning teachers, maybe sentimentalists who don't think God would send anybody to hell. Or maybe they wish to leave some room for works. That's our heart's bent, isn't it? It is our default setting. Every religion on the face of the earth has room for work merit. That somehow we can work and merit our own salvation. Biblical Christianity is the only world religion, we can say that exclusively after having looked at world religions earlier this summer. Biblical Christianity is the only world religion that says, no, you cannot do a thing to labor merit of justification for yourself. It is all of grace. Some insist on leaving room for works. Even the Roman Catholic Catechism insists on man's work form part of his justification. The new perspective on Paul, teachers like Sanders and Dunn also, consequently some Federal Vision teachers as well, leaving some room for works. There are basically three options on how to take this portion of Scripture. Number one, some have interpreted the idea of merit here, that indeed they are a law unto themselves, Gentiles. That is, Gentiles who fulfill the law and are saved apart from faith in Christ. That's option number one. Some, through the history of the church, we'll see some of these even in church history, our study this coming week. It was the view of some early church and medieval teachers as well. Later became the basis for natural law universalism in the Enlightenment, too. Second option is Gentiles who do some part of the law but who are not saved. It's the majority view of the Reformers as well. That there are, indeed are Gentiles, the innocent native in Africa, who does a portion of the law, part of the law, but who is not saved. Third option, these are Gentile Christians, these who have the law written in their hearts now because of their renewal in Jesus Christ. They are Gentile Christians who fulfill the law by virtue of their relationship to Christ. But once more, Paul is building his case for grace. He's building his case for grace and has not yet introduced those who have such a relationship. So this is a bit premature to assume this as his subject. Okay? Well then, how can option number two is the one, I think, that comes closest to what Paul is driving at in his sustained argument. That he is indeed talking about Gentiles who do some part of the law but who are not saved. Because as Paul will tell us later, it is only perfect obedience that saves. What are we going to do then? Did you all start thinking about what we're going to do? If it's perfect obedience and perfect obedience alone that saves, what are we going to do? My heart starts longing for maybe having somebody else's obedience step in my place. And that's a good trail to go down. If you indeed are sniffing at it, you're a hound on the trail. Well, then, how can Gentiles be a law unto themselves? What is Paul talking about as Gentiles a law unto themselves? Paul goes on to say, Gentiles show that they have the work of the law. Gentiles show, that is, make apparent, they make manifest in their lives. We see it in the law codes of Hammurabi, if you will, or in Rome or in Greece. Gentiles show that they have the law. No, look how Paul qualifies this. They show that they have the work of the law written on their heart. The work of the law. He's being very precise here. Rather than a true sense of God's law proceeding from God's person, that is Yahweh, the personal revealed name that he gave to Israel, given in love, and the law given in the specificity of the Torah, all these things Israel could claim, but not Gentiles. Rather than having that law, it is rather a vague, generalized sense of the kind of conduct or work expected of a moral person. The work of the law they have in their hearts. The Greeks and the Romans had developed a philosophy of natural law inherent in all men. Paul is alluding to this. I quote from Cicero now, just to show you, eloquent Cicero. I had to translate this in Latin, so I want to work it into a sermon here at some point in my life, and this is the day. Cicero says, true law is right reason in agreement with nature. Now, our founding fathers drank deeply from the well of Cicero as they drew from the Romans for the idea of a republic. Cicero unfolds the nature of a true republic. Our republic is based on some, at least, of the thinking and attitudes of men like Cicero. And Cicero says, true law is right reason in agreement with nature. That is the heart, the natural heart of man. It is of universal application, unchanging and everlasting. It summons to duty by its commands and averts from wrongdoing by its prohibitions. So you see, you have the stipulations of the covenant here, even in Cicero. It is a sin to try to alter this law, nor is it allowable to repeal any part of it, and it is impossible to abolish it. There will be no different laws at Rome and at Athens. It's universal. Or different laws now and in the future. It is eternal. But one eternal and unchangeable law, Cicero says, will be valid for all nations and at all times, and there will be one master and ruler, that is God, over us all, for he is the author of this law, its promulgator, and its enforcing judge, unquote. Extensive from Cicero, but I'm able to show off my translation and show you as well this nature of the universal law that Paul is talking about here in Romans chapter 2. Paul is probably alluding to this tradition here, adds another element to this right reason in agreement with nature. That is, the monitor of performance, the conscience of the individual. He says, while their conscience also bears witness. So you have not only the law written on the heart, but then you have the monitor of the performance according to that law, that is the conscience. Dr. Mu defines it this way, the conscience, that reflective mechanism by which people can measure their conformity to a norm. And that conscience speaks in the human heart and spirit. Oh, there's a spot. Oh, damn it, spot. Right? The conscience of Lady Macbeth speaking according to her performance to the law, driving her into despair, despair that leads to suicide. How often do we see this in the lives of people around us? Perhaps you have friends and relatives just nagged by their conscience. One psychiatrist that I worked with as a member of our congregation, the very first congregation that I served, said, Pastor, you realize how we could empty mental institutions if we could just assuage people's guilt? He said, guilt is the driver of insanity. Guilt is the driver of schizophrenia. I'm always reminded of one of my favorite Disney characters here, too, in terms of conscience, Jiminy Cricket, right, from Pinocchio. Parents, rent this for your kids. It is indeed very much of what Paul is talking about here, Jiminy Cricket. So when you think of Paul and conscience, think of little Jiminy Cricket. Always let your conscience be your guide, right? He tries to keep Pinocchio from skipping school and from smoking, playing pool, right? He ends up growing donkey ears, doesn't he? Becomes a fool like a dummy like a donkey for skipping school. Jiminy Cricket, all through Pinocchio, says, take the straight and narrow path, and if you start to slide, give a little whistle, right? And always let your conscience be your guide. Now, as that conscience does its work, a la Lady Macbeth, Paul indicates that sometimes turbulent nature of that results. He talks about their conflicting thoughts. And that is the conscience, isn't it? Am I right? Am I wrong? Their conflicting thoughts either accuse or even excuse them. With a time marker here, it says, it is only on that day when, right, is the day of judgment that he talks about, illuminating some very interesting things here about that day of judgment. Here, our own consciences will participate in our own judgment. There will be no gainsaying. There will be no hiding. There will be no compromising. Indeed, what has been whispered in secret will be shouted from the housetops, Jesus says. That's that sense of open and naked before the God with whom we have to do, as the author of Hebrews puts it. Our own consciences will participate and confirm God's judgment as our own thoughts accuse, or as Paul says, even. Even excuse. That little word even, in Greek, it's a concessive particle, they say, meant to emphasize the rarity of what follows. In other words, our conscience excusing us will be pretty rare. There will be nothing to hide. Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Dave Bass. Keep that in mind when you come to confession of sin. Know that God knows you and sees you, knows every angle and twist and turn of your soul, conscience, and excuse making. It's in line with Paul and the rest of the New Testament. Jesus says, the Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son. Paul will say later, according to my gospel, he says this in multiple places. In Corinthians, he says, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. The works principle, brothers and sisters. Paul is sustaining his argument on the works principle. We will be judged, we will be made just, we will be declared just and righteous, or no, according to what we have done, according to our works. Well, so with the Gentile, what about the Jew who has the law? Surely he has a leg up, right? They would be saying this. 17 to 24. Indelible. God's judgment is righteous and impartial towards all men, because it is manifest in the Jews in particular, who have the revealed law extrinsic to their hearts and yet cannot keep it. They have the law. You could turn to the opening verses of chapter 9, for example, and see how the Apostle Paul extols the advantages that the Jews have, what glories they have in the law, and you see the pageantry of the temple, the beauty of it, the revelation of the beautiful living creator, the God of Israel, Yahweh, the personal name given to the Jews. Paul now becomes quite explicit in his treatment of his brethren, the Jew. Now, you know, he returns now to the diatribe style, right? We've been in the second person or third person plural all through these opening verses where he's talking about the Gentiles. Now that he's coming back to his own brethren, his fellow Jewish brethren, he returns then to that diatribe style, imagining an opponent taking another position, which Paul will here oppose. But in his imagination, he has it before him. He has him before him. Puts his argument in the strongest terms to which the dialoguer would agree. Right? That is indeed what I believe. Anticipating objections and exceptions, he structures the whole argument such that a rabbi would appreciate it. As you look over these verses, you see a series of conditional sentences, right? If this, then that. Several conditional sentences there. And then you also have a series of rhetorical questions. Surprising for a Jew, right? To answer a question with a question. A whole series of rhetorical questions with a final stinging conclusion then. We see this exampled throughout the Bible, whether it's Nathan with David. Nathan does the same thing. He gets David's head shaking, gets him enthusiastic about finding out who this guy is, and then he pulls the noose, doesn't he? He says, "It's you." We see the same thing with Stephen in his speech before the Jews in the temple, right? Gets them shaking their heads, recounts Israel's history. Yeah, isn't it glorious? Isn't it? But you, oh hypocrites, he says, right? We see this throughout Scripture. Paul is doing the same thing here. He's going to get his audience nodding their heads first. In order of ascending importance, for example, verse 17, we have the first conditional sentence. He says, if you're a Jew, that is one of the chosen, and you rely on the law, evoking memories of Moses on Sinai, the glory of the covenant. If you rely on the law as a means of justification, not conviction of sin driving you to grace, but rather as a means of justification, which many of them did. If you boast in God, you have this personal relationship with Yahweh, right? Like we have a personal relationship with Jesus. Well, Israel had a personal relationship with Yahweh, having that personal name that they could embrace. Well, two corollaries then follow in verse 18. Knowing the law, you know his will. Knowing the law, this is underlined in the face of the hypocrisy about to be laid at their feet. You know the law, what a blessing it is. So consequently, then you know his will. And secondly, knowing the law, you know how to behave. Do you not, you see, recounted for you in verse 18. You know his will and approve what is excellent because you are instructed from the law. You know the laws, consequently you know his will. Knowing the law, then you know how to behave. That's that sense of instruction. The second conditional sentence, now beginning in 19, gives four valuable prerogatives that Jews had toward others, looking outside, towards the world now. Remember, we read from the law today, do this law, embrace it, and the nations will say, what a great God you have. What other nation has a law like this? What other nation has this personal relationship with Yahweh, like you did? That was to be their evangelism, reaching out then to the nations. You yourself, emphatic here, since you yourself have in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you consider yourselves then to be a guide to the blind. Indeed, the Old Testament is filled with that, right? Israel is to be a guide to the blind. Jesus remarks on this condition. You consider yourselves a guide to the blind, but you're the blind leading the blind. They are to be a light to those in darkness. This is the sense of wisdom and the word. This is all plucked from the wisdom literature, if you will. You're a light to those in darkness. You're an instructor of the foolish, the chokmah, the wise, versus the nabal, the fool. You're a teacher of children, always the next generation mind in mind for all, right? The law is insistent. Son, listen to the words of your father, the wisdom literature says. All of these Paul knew from his own training days under Gamaliel. They were button shiners, if you will, for his fellow Pharisees too, because they all knew him. And this was a form that they would hear time and time again, recounting the glorious history, the glorious past, and hopefully the glorious future of Israel. That is why the rhetorical questions that follow are also so stinging to them. Once again, he's getting their head shaking. He says, yeah, we're all that. We're all that and more. Then he begins with his rhetorical questions. Are you a teacher? Do you teach yourself? That is, do you teach yourself the following? And then he picks up some exaggerated, egregious examples of sin and lays them before them. Do you preach and teach against stealing and yet steal yourself? Do you preach and teach against adultery and yet commit adultery yourself? Do you decry idolatry and yet rob temples? There's that sense of using stolen metals for your own use or contributing it even to the temple. There's record of that in the Talmud. And also Deuteronomy 7:26, for example, the Old Testament says, do not use the metals of idolaters in the nations you are going over to conquer. So he picks out these egregious sins and says, Israel, you have been guilty of these things. Not all of you. Not even the majority of you, but Israel has been guilty of these sins in hypocrisy. Once again, Paul is doing what the New Testament gives us ample evidence. Jesus would do the same thing. He'd get his audience shaking their heads, and then he'd pull the cord. When Paul preaches to the Jews in the temple, he does the same thing, doesn't he? He does the same thing as Stephen did, recounts the history, the glories of Israel, what God has entrusted them with, and then they have hypocritically forfeited it all. His final conclusion, enough to make them gnash their teeth, right? How did the audiences respond in these respective instances? David heard when the cord was pulled, right? You are the man, David. He repented. The Jews to whom Stephen preached rushed him, didn't they? Stoned him to death. Paul, they're about to do the same thing to him. A Roman centurion saved him. How do these respond, do you think? When he finally pulls the cord on them, he says, you who boast in the law dishonor God by breaking the law. You who boast in the law dishonor God by breaking the law. He's not going to shine their buttons on this one. He's going to bring them to the same ground as the Gentiles. They have indelible law written on their hearts. You have that plus. He says, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. The name of God is blasphemed. That's citing Isaiah there. Indeed, even as the Gentiles were repentant and came to God after the preaching of Jonah, Jesus draws on that and says, they will be your judges in the final day, in the day of judgment. Do not presume upon the covenant. We now have so much more than they do, don't we? Does that make you shudder? Does that make you think twice? Because we have even more than the audience of the Jews that Paul had. We have more light than they do. Having the gospel, the new covenant, all the bragging about the covenant and the elucidation of the benefits of the covenant given to the Jews can be multiplied in our case. How humbling it is to consider what we are responsible for in terms of light. So do not presume upon the covenant. Do not let your children presume upon the blessed covenant that they have. And do not rely upon your works to be righteous before God, brothers and sisters. Once again, Paul is establishing this ground of judgment, that is, our works. Don't let other people rely upon their works. This is a matter of evangelism, too. As you talk with your brothers and sisters, as you talk with those who do not yet know God and His grace, do not let them rely upon their works. That's one of the first issues you must clear up with them. What does this do to your heart, brothers and sisters, as you consider it? If God is going to judge me on my works, where do I stand? What are my odds? What are my chances? If indeed on that day there will be no hiding, all of who and what Dave Bass is will be there before the throne of judgment, before His bar of complete and absolute justice, or nothing but pure, entire, complete obedience is required. Shining obedience, which Adam indeed was capable of doing, but which I am utterly incapable of doing. What am I to do? As I toss and turn at night pondering these things, my heart cries out for a substitute. What if I had? What if I had somebody who would stand in my place? You know, just like the Israelites, once they found out who God is, bring Him on, Israel said, right? Bring Him on. And then they trembled and quaked when He did descend on Sinai in lightning and thunder and earthquake and smoke and fire. This was the God with whom they had to do. And they said, Moses, you go in our stead, okay, so we don't die? Well, that's a picture of what the judgment will be like. And on that day, I want somebody to go and stand for me. And if you're beginning to think like that yourself, you're beginning to think like Paul, because he will unfold these things in chapters to come. But for now, once again, I'm not going to make an altar call. A come to Jesus moment here today in this particular service. I want you to hang with me a little bit over that fire and ponder indeed what it would be like to stand there in your own works on that day as we work our way. This will be the basis upon which all men will be called to account, on the basis of their works. And unless you've got somebody else and somebody else's works to stand in your stead, you're toast. With that eloquent metaphor, let us consider indeed the one who has stood in our place and the labors that He has accomplished in our behalf in the breaking of His body and the shedding of His blood. As we come to the body and blood of the Lord and the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.